It's good to be with you today. You know, when Jesus rose from the dead, he wasn't just resuscitated. Think about that. He wasn't just resuscitated. He didn't just, you know, somebody didn't do CPR on him. But he was actually transformed, and his body was an eternal, immortal, new body, right? Now, you know, the wounds of Christ were still in his hands. You ever think to yourself, why, if he had a transformed body and he had an immortal body, why the wounds were still there? You ever think about that? I remember when my wife Tara and I were living in London, our first place. It was very small, about the size of this platform, maybe a little smaller, actually. And she told me that her mom was coming to visit for a week. Now, immediately, I'm thinking to myself, okay, so things got to be in order, all right, because, you know, I don't want mom thinking, you know, her daughter's not well, all the way away, far away from home, right? And then she says, oh, she's going to be here for about a week, and she's going to come to church with us on Sunday. And then I got really nervous. I was tempted to feel really embarrassed because, you know, I was an associate pastor of a church in London, really, really small church, like really small. Like once all the members were kind of in place, you know, somebody was in the back to greet folks, somebody was in the kitchen making snacks for after service. And once everybody was in place, there was nobody in the seats. Like, I'm talking like, you know, like really small. And so when newcomers would come in, they'd be the only ones there. And then it'd be really awkward because you tell people, okay, let's stand. And they're like, all right, I guess I'll stand, you know. And so, you know, when I knew that my mother-in-law was coming to visit, you know, I was tempted to kind of feel a little like, you know, a little embarrassed because, you know, my little, this small little church. Now, most of the time, I felt tremendous honor to serve there because, you know, I wasn't serving there because of the numbers. I was there for the people. And, you know, most of the time I felt, you know, it was an honor to serve there. But, you know, on some days, if I was honest, I would think to myself, you know, God brought me all the way over here for this. Like, this is my life right now. This is my purpose right now. This is my impact right now. And sometimes that happens. You know, when you give your life to the Lord and you're walking with Christ for a while, sometimes you stop and you look around your life and you go, is this it? Like, is this my life right now? Is this my family right now? Is this my marriage right now? Is this my impact on the world right now? Is this it? I mean, is this why I gave my life to Christ for this? You ever think that? If we're honest, because let's be honest. I mean, we all want the same thing, which is we want to be alive. We want to feel alive. We want to live a life that's full of purpose and meaning and significance and deep joy. And it explains a lot of what we do. You know, it's why writers write and runners run and athletes compete. You know, it's why chefs cook. Because we are looking to be alive and to feel alive. And we all want that feeling that our lives mean something. And that desire doesn't change once you become a follower of Jesus. It doesn't change at all. In fact, for a lot of us, it's the reason why we became a follower of Jesus. Because we figured out that life according to the world, life according to you know, what the world says a good life is, wasn't working. And we found in Jesus an alternative that, you know, maybe Jesus has something to offer that the world doesn't have to offer. Because I tried the world and that didn't work. And so we started following Jesus. And then we're walking with Jesus. And we have this anticipation because Jesus said, I came to give you life and life to the full. We're like, all right, Jesus, I'm on board. Let's do this. And then 5 years later, 10 years later, you're looking around, you're going, where's the life? Where is it? I don't see it, Lord, help me, because I'm looking at my life and it doesn't look like much right now. My life doesn't look like much right now. What do you do when you are doing your best to follow the Lord and you step back and you look at your life and you don't see God? You don't see anything significant. You don't see life. What do you do? If you've ever felt that way, you're in good company, because we've been journeying through the Gospel of John together, and John's audience in his gospel, the Christian portion of his audience, were losers. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. I mean that just literally, like, they were the losers of society. They had been persecuted severely. Their leaders were in and out of jail. They had lost all manner of respect and prestige in their communities. Not the things that you think of when you talk about life to the full. Right? And so it kind of begs the question, where did they get their life from? You know, like, where did they get their significance from? If they were, in the world's eye, such losers, such nobodies, where in the world were they getting their life from? And when John talks about the resurrection of Jesus, he addresses this very issue. He gives us some insight on how do you find life in a life that looks like it has no life. How do you respond when you look at your life and you don't see much? Or when you look at your life and you see something that's worse off than people that you know who are not followers of Jesus? Because that's what it looked like for the early Christians. I mean, following Jesus wasn't something that made your life better. You know, who wants to be persecuted? Who wants to be socially ostracized? Rumors spreading about who you are, in and out of jail, your goods confiscated, you lose everything. That doesn't sound like a better life to me. How do you find life when you look at your life and you don't see life? You don't see significance. You don't see God's promise. What do? John addresses this when he talks about, when he gives his account of the resurrection, and it starts with Jesus's encounter with Mary Magdalene. You know, Mary Magdalene was the reject. She had a very troubled past. But she's the first one to see the risen Lord. And Jesus, she actually becomes the first preacher, because Jesus tells her to go and tell the disciples that he had risen from the dead. She goes and tells the disciples that Jesus is risen from the dead. And they don't believe her until they see Jesus for himself. But someone's not there when Jesus comes and visits the disciples. You know who wasn't there? Thomas. Thomas wasn't there. And Thomas gets a bad rep, because when the disciples go to tell Thomas that Jesus had risen from the dead, he's like, I'm not going to believe it. I'm not going to believe it till I see him myself. And I don't know how he got this reputation of being doubting Thomas, because none of the disciples believed Mary when she told them. You know, it's like, if you don't believe a woman's word, you're normal. But if you don't believe a man's word, now you're doubtful. Uh-huh. That's another sermon for another day. But so Jesus comes again to Thomas. When Thomas is in the room with the disciples, he comes again. And we're going to pick up the story when Jesus encounters Thomas. And it's in John chapter 20. We're actually going to pick up on verse 27. It said, then he, Jesus, said to Thomas, put your finger here and look at my hands. Put your hand into the wound in my side. He's telling him to probe, inspect. It's me. And he's referencing his wounds from his crucifixion. It's me. Look at my hands. Look at the wound in my side. Don't doubt any longer. Believe. And Thomas exclaimed, what? My Lord and my God. Everybody say, my Lord and my God. Okay. Then Jesus told him, you believe because you have seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing me. The disciples saw Jesus do many other miracles, miraculous signs, in addition to the ones recorded in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you may have life in his name. Now, before we jump in, we have to talk about context, because We've been hearing this theme over several weeks now, that historical context matters. If you want to understand the words on a page, you have to understand the story and the world behind the page. If Wile E. Coyote said, "I'm going to get you." If a detective said, "I'm going to get you." If the boogeyman said, "I'm going to get you," they mean three different things. And you only know that they mean three different things because you know the historical context behind each story. Some of them fictional, some of them true. Right? When Wile E. Coyote says, "I'm going to get you," who's he talking to? The Roadrunner. He's not even talking to you. He's talking to the Roadrunner. Right? When the detective says, "I'm going to get you," he's talking to you. And what's he talking about? He's talking about prosecuting you. I'm going to put you in jail. When the boogeyman says, "I'm going to get you," what does he mean? I'm going to eat you. I'm going to gobble you up. Right? Now, we could use a more modern example. If someone said, if you're talking to somebody, you're telling them a very sensational story, and they say, "Get out of here." What do they mean? They mean, "Are you serious? I need some confirmation that what you're telling me is true." Right? Now, if someone walks in on you in the bathroom and you say, "Get out of here," you mean something a little different. Right? Because context matters. If you want to understand the words that someone is saying or the words that are written on a page, you have to understand the story, the context behind it. So we're going to take a little look at the story behind the page, as it were, in this account of the resurrection. And the first are these words that Thomas declares about Jesus. Thomas says to Jesus, "My Lord and my God." Now, to our ears, we hear, well, he's acknowledging that Jesus is divine, that he isn't just human, but he's God incarnate, that he's God and man, and he's acknowledging his divinity. And that's true. In the Hebrew scriptures, you know, they refer to God as Lord, and they also refer to God as God. But rarely do they ever bring Lord and God together. It happens actually twice. Once in the Minor Prophets and once in the Psalms. It only happens twice. But this phrase, Lord and God, is much more common in a different way in this society and in the first century world. There's a man by the name of Domitian, Domitian. He was the emperor of Rome. And he made the bold proclamation. He wanted people to start calling him Lord and God. So if you're in the first century world and you see and you hear a story about somebody calling Jesus, somebody other than the emperor, Lord and God, your ears are perked. Because the title that is usually given to the emperor is now being given to Jesus. And then John goes on to say that all of these accounts, all these stories in the Gospel of John were written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Son of God. There's another title. Before Jesus was called the Son of God, the emperor was also called Son of God. The reason is because when emperors died, they in Roman society became divine. They became gods. And so the emperor, the new emperor, was called Son of God. And before there was a gospel of Jesus, there was a gospel of Caesar. There was a gospel of Rome. There was a story being propagated throughout the world to say, good news, the Son of God, the emperor, is king of the world. He will bring peace. He will bring prosperity. He will bring justice. The world will be a better place because our emperor, the Son of God, is in charge. So when Jesus comes along and people start calling him the Son of God, people are going, uh-oh, what do you mean? You're saying that Caesar is not the Son of God? You're saying Caesar is not the source of true life? So when John is telling this story of Jesus' resurrection, he's being deliberate in bringing the conversation between the message of society in Rome, the Roman Empire, and the message of Jesus. And he's bringing them into intentional conversation. To the point where to say that Jesus is the Son of God, you're not only acknowledging he's the Son of God, you're saying that Caesar is not. You're saying that Jesus' message is true. You're saying that Caesar's message is not true. And why is that important? It's important because in the Roman world, if you were to believe that Caesar was the Son of God, that means you ascribed, you pledged allegiance to a particular way of thinking, to a particular way of life, which had a lot to do with respecting the hierarchy of society. You were supposed to honor the emperor as a god and honor those in authority as a little less than God. And you had to respect the hierarchy. It went emperor, governors, heads of household, which wasn't just fathers. It was the oldest man in the family. All right. And then at the bottom were women, children, and slaves. But then Jesus comes along and starts saying things like, well, if you want to enter the kingdom, you have to become like a child. And he didn't mean you have to be naive. He meant you have to relinquish any kind of desire to have power over other people. He comes in and starts saying things like, to be the greatest, you have to be the servant of all. He starts saying things like, what you do to the least of these is what you do to me. So instead of pledging allegiance to this hierarchy, he actually disrupts it. He challenges it. And he says, life, true life, doesn't come through Caesar, through following any kind of hierarchy, trying to climb the ladder of society. It actually comes through another way of being humble, being lowly, loving, intentionally caring for those on the margins of society. That's how you find life. And all this is going on in people's heads when they see these words, Son of God. He's saying, not only is he saying that Jesus is the Messiah and that Jesus' message is true, he's saying that the message of society, the message of Rome, is not true. And why does this matter? This matters because he says that you have to believe. This word, believing in him, so that you may have life, is an ongoing word. The verb in the Greek implies an ongoing action. This isn't a one-time action. It's an ongoing action. And believing in Jesus isn't just believing in his titles or believing that he exists. It's believing in his message, believing in his way of seeing the world, that his way of seeing the world really is true. The greatest really are those who serve. It really does matter more what you do to the least than what you do to the greatest. Like, that's really true. And why does that matter for us? It matters for us because when we give our lives to the Lord and we start walking with the Lord and we're excited and we're anticipating all the life that comes from walking with the Lord, what ends up happening is over time, we'll walk with the Lord, but then look at our lives through the lens of the world. We'll try to believe Jesus and believe the world at the same time. And we judge the significance of our lives through the lens of what society says a good life ought to look like. And you can't mix the life of Jesus with the lens of society. It will never, ever look like much. It will never look like anything. If you try to look at a life, the life of Jesus or a life of a follower of Jesus through the lens of society, it will always look stupid. It will always look like a failure. It will always look like a loser. This is what Jesus was on the cross. When society looked at Jesus on the cross, they saw a failure. They saw somebody who was abandoned by God, not somebody who was victorious. And even Jesus himself, there were things as he was experiencing his crucifixion, he didn't even understand it. That's why he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? But even in the midst of the horror of the cross, he was able to look at the thief next to him and say, today you shall be with me in paradise. He was operating on a completely different spectrum. He was seeing life from a completely different perspective. How can you look at something so horrible, something so the epitome of failure, and see something so glorious? Today you will be with me in paradise. It's because he did not subscribe to the way his society saw the world. He took those lenses off and put on a different lens. And for us, believing in Jesus means taking off the lens of the world. Stop trying to look at your life through the lens of society, because you'll just discourage yourself every single day. If you're really trying to live for Jesus, you're just going to be discouraged all the time. Because you're going to look at your life and think, it should be more than this. It should be more than this. What am I doing? What is this really about? Until you change your lens. When you say no to the Roman way, no to the American dream, no to what society says is successful, is significant, is great. No, you got to say no. You got to be direct, explicit, no. Because we've all been socialized in a certain way, and it shapes our expectations. There's certain expectations you have of what your life should look like at the age of 18, at the age of 21, at the age of 25, at the age of 30, 35, 40. You have these expectations of when you should be married, when you should start having kids, when you should get that promotion on your job. Where do those expectations come from? Not the gospel. It comes from society, doesn't it? And so unless we're intentional with the lens through which we understand our lives, we'll go through life thinking our lives are just a heap of garbage when there's actually glory to be found in there. Jesus said the kingdom of God is like a small seed planted in the ground. What in our world, what in our society honors things that are small? Think about it. Especially in America. I mean, our cars are big, our roads are big, our houses, you know, we like our houses big. I mean, you really learn this when you live overseas. When I was living in Europe, everything is small. Cars are small, the houses are small, everything, the portions of your food are small, the soda cans are small, everything is small compared to what you see over here. We always think bigger is better. The bigger my bank account, the better. The bigger my reputation, the better. The more people that respect me, the better. Right? Money, power, and respect. Some of y'all know that reference. Right? Money, power, and respect. That's our society. Right? And we start walking with Jesus. And if we're trying to be faithful to live the life he's leading us to live, and we look around, we don't see the money. We don't see the power. We don't see the respect. And we think something's wrong. God, am I doing something wrong? God, am I disobeying you in some way? God, am I on the right track? No, you're not on the wrong. You're on the right track, but you're looking at your life through the wrong lens. You know, is it really true when Jesus says it's better to give than to receive? Like, is that really true? That's what believing Jesus is about. Believing that that's really true. That it really is better to give than to receive. And it's an ongoing process, this ongoing process of putting on the lens of the gospel, the lens of Jesus on the way we interpret our lives. It's something we have to be intentional about, because if we're not intentional about it, we'll just go back to default and start looking at our lives through American culture. And sometimes when your life is at its lowest, it's actually at its greatest. I believe one of the reasons why Jesus kept those marks on his hands and his feet for eternity is a reminder that sometimes when it looks like everything is going wrong, when it looks like your life has been forsaken by God, when you look like an absolute failure, is actually the time when your life is the most significant, is the most powerful. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of somebody's assassination. You know who it is. Martin Luther King Jr., April 4th, 1968. At the end of his life, he was not successful in the eyes of society. His approval ratings, even in the black community, were less than 50%, because he started talking about things like the war in Vietnam instead of only talking about civil rights domestically. He was considered an enemy of the state. He was considered a threat to national security. The FBI was investigating him. He was in and out of jail. He was not successful in the eyes of the world. But it was at his lowest point. If he had not died, I don't think his life would have the impact that it has. And that seems horrible to say. But I think it's true. I think when you look at his life, I don't think it would have had the same impact had he not shed blood for it. But that's the kind of lens you have when you try to see things through the lens of the gospel. That you live when you die. You gain the world when you lose, when you pour yourself out, when you serve others, even unto death. And so the one thing I want you to know today, here's the one point, is that to experience God's life, you must apply God's lens. To experience God's life, you must apply God's lens daily. Apply his lens. Because God could be using you in ways you have no idea, but you don't see it because you're looking at it through the wrong lens. Your life could be so much more than you think it is, and nothing has to change other than your perspective. And just imagine, if you began to see your life through the lens of the gospel, through the lens that says the greatest are those who serve, that what matters more is who you love, that what matters more is the quality of your service for other people, what would change? What if your life would be seen from a completely different perspective? What if you saw things that you never would have thought you would have seen before? If you just change that lens. And this is, in a way, this is an invitation to continue this journey that we're going on through John's gospel, because John's gospel is all about seeing things from a different perspective. Even in this series, it's called More Than Meets the Eye, that starts next week. There's just more to life than what you see. And part of walking with Jesus is letting Jesus fine-tune your lens and clean your lens and correct your lens. You know, I've been wearing glasses for the majority of my life, and just about every year when I was growing up, I'd have to go get my eyes checked, right? You ever get your eyes checked? You have to sit in front of that big machine, and it's like click, 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 right? We need to do the same thing spiritually. We need to give ourselves a checkup. How's your vision? How are those lenses? Do they work? Are you seeing clearly? Or are things distorted because you kind of picked up some of the residue of society's expectations, or maybe your family's expectations? My suspicion is that there's greatness all in the room today. Society may not see you and look at your life and call it great. They're not right. It's tempting to believe the message of a society that's very powerful and prominent. It was very easy in the Roman world to just take what the Romans said as true. Oh, look at their army. They got so many armies. They got so much power. They run the world. They've got to be right. No. So whose message will you believe? Whose lens will you wear today, tomorrow? Society or the gospel? I want to give you a few moments to think about it.